Chapter 6 begins with a continuation of some of the things that were talked about in 5, that is the efforts of the Pharisees to call out Jesus as a lawbreaker. And again, the continuing response of Jesus that since he is who he says he is, he's actually in charge of the Sabbath, so you can't enforce the Sabbath on him. He's the one who's regulating the Sabbath and who's the source of the Sabbath. So I may come back to that, but I wanted to start, if I could, with 12. In those days he went out to the hills to pray. All night he continued in prayer to God. And when it was day, he called his disciples, chose them from among the 12, whom he named apostles. Simon, whom he named Peter, Andrew, James, John, right? We have the list. Finally, Judas, son of James, Judas Iscariot, who became the traitor. And there's in the commentary, there's fairly extensive notes on 12, because it talked about how it is that he prayed all night. Now, this in, if you read this in basically up to the early part of the 20th century, there's this Christian practice that is called watching. You will see it called watching, or you will see it called keeping vigil. And this wasn't just praying, but in particular, it was praying at night. So what Jesus does becomes simply incorporated into the prayer life of Christians, and you know, the more serious or more devout the Christian was, the more likely there was going to be something like this. So it could be for us, this kind of thing you get exposed to if you're, let's say, you sign up for adoration, and you have these hours that you know that nobody really wants: 1 in the morning, 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning. We don't as often liturgically have what used to happen more in the early church and the medieval church, these all-night vigils, where you had some kind of evening service. It could be Mass, it could be evensong or night prayer. And then through the night, there would simply be prayer. That prayer could be vocal, could be chanted, it could be silent prayer. And it simply went through the night into the morning. One of Rachmaninoff's liturgical pieces is the Vespers. If you're interested in that, I have particular versions to recommend. But it's the all-night vigil. And obviously it's not a recording, it's all night. The recording itself is like about 50 minutes. But really what you're doing is it sort of highlights from the psalms and hymns that would be sung through the night on a high feast day. So let's say Pentecost, night before Pentecost, or around the Triduum, or you would have these, you know, high feast days where you would be basically singing through the night. But even that's liturgically. Privately, personally, you would have devout people who would be praying into the, let's say, you know, in the middle of the night, or be praying in the early morning. And the model they're taking from is from our Lord himself. That there's something about the quietness of the night, the solitude of the night, that the day is just always full of distractions. And that by praying at night, you're somehow removing those distractions. One of my favorite moments, and this is now from many years ago, of being on retreat with seniors. We used to go out to Koinonia, which is out in Annandale. It's a Methodist retreat house, but it's a very nice one. And the Dominicans, this is Father Jacek and Father Maciej, so this is a while ago, they had a Mass, which I want to say was like 10:30 or 11 o'clock. So it was all dark outside. This was October. It was right around this time of year. And they just had the candles. And there were, how many seniors back then? Probably about 60 or so, and about 25 of them. It was, you know, it was voluntary. Show up if you like. About 25 of them showed up, and it was funny. About a third of them Protestant. A number of the Lutherans and the Evangelicals showed up for it. But there was just something very different about having this having this liturgy, you know, kind of at night with the candles and the quiet and the calm outside and so on. Also, October, aren't as many birds even outside. You're just there's that silence. So the idea of watching and keeping vigil is that you're taking this place that's freer of distractions. And taking it for a longer time, not 5 or 10 minutes, but this is really something which you're taking advantage of that solitude and silence to go deeper and deeper into prayer. And notice he rises from this in the morning and he's going out and getting his apostles. And again, the message is that somehow it's in this prayer at night that gives you the strength to do things during the day. And I know you can hear that and think, no, I would just be totally hungover. I'd be totally groggy if I tried to do this. And it is certainly something that takes getting used to. If it isn't something that is a part of your life, you're right. That would be the immediate impact of it. But evidently, this was something that our Lord did as a kind of habit, where he would pray at night. Go ahead, Mrs. Bettina.
Right. They were going into battle the next day.
Yep. And they're imitating what, of course, remember I put up the 7 hours of prayer. So Compline, that's night prayer. But then Matins, morning prayer, is actually being said in the middle of the night. And Lauds is being said basically at dawn. Or actually just before dawn, because Prime, which is usually said around 5:30 or 6, it's the first hour of the day. Prime is being said as the sun is coming up. Yeah, if you're like you in bed are just, you know, brothers, you're together forever, you know, monastic life is going to be a little rough for you. Because they're just like, and I never understood this when I learned this in nursery school or pre-K or whatnot, Frère Jacques, morning bells are ringing. Brother John, in other words, these are monks. Get up, get out of bed. Matina, the morning bells, the matin bells are ringing. The matin bells are ringing. Matutina, I forget what it is in French, but the morning bells are ringing. You know, get your hinder out of bed. It's time to pray. Yeah, don't think it's like 8 o'clock in the morning and he's sleeping in. No, that Frère Jacques business is probably, you know, more like 1 in the morning or midnight or, yeah. I gave you a list of psalms here. 134, 119, 77, 42, 3. Hopefully the numbers match. I got this out of Lapide, so these are Douay-Rheims numbers. Sometimes they're one psalm off as you get into the later psalms. But basically, these are all psalms in which David is expressing prayer and devotion at night. I have wept at night. I have prayed at night. I have called for you in the night. So this devotion, it goes back to the Old Testament. Our Lord is not doing, as it were, something new here. The devotion of praying at night and the stillness of the night and seeking the Lord at night is something you see throughout the Psalms. So of course, as monks and other devout Christians are saying these Psalms, you know, some number of them they're saying are speaking to this very experience of seeking the Lord in the quiet of the night. There also, conversely, is the idea that, you know, that time of darkness, yes, it has its advantages for solitude, but it also bears with it the idea of protection against evil, that darkness in some way represents the time of the evil one. So that, remember, it used to be part of Catholic life, and teaching a prayer life to children. You gave them the Angel of God prayer. You said it in the morning, but you also said, Angel of God, my guardian dear, to whom God's love commits me here, ever this night be at my side. You could say it in the morning, ever this day, but also the idea, ever this night, to light, to guard, to rule, and guide. And especially if you think about those four things, to light, to guard, to rule, and guide. That's especially fitting at night, because, of course, if you're sleeping, those are the powers that are, you know, your powers of reason and self-control are dormant. You know, that's why you dream. Your imagination is now running free. Your emotion, unspoken desires often have the opportunity to run free. So that somehow your angel is still there, as it were, helping exercise the functions of reason, to light, you know, to give you understanding, to guard, to protect you against, you know, bad thoughts and bad notions, to guide, to point out the path for you, and to rule. You know, reason is supposed to be how you're directing your life. And of course, you know, in sleep, that's not happening. But that somehow your angel is still there helping you out, you know, during the night. Okay. Let's look over here. This is on the Beatitudes. You can read in commentary where it's as if there's this one event where our Lord gives the Beatitudes, and you know, he gives them one way in Matthew and gives them a different way in Luke, and it's like, is, you know, is this sort of the same speech and it's reported in different ways, or, you know, there was this event and they're so far after the event that one person remembers one thing and one person remembers the other? You know, I think a far easier explanation is, do we really believe that Jesus only gave the Beatitudes once? You know, if you were lucky enough to be in that crowd at that point and get those Beatitudes, great, but, you know, sorry. You know, we talk in the political world, the American political world, about stump speeches. You're going to have a candidate go to all these whistle stops, you know, touring through Colorado and Nebraska and so on. They're going to have a set of prepared remarks that they're going to make. I was looking up something on stump speeches. I think it was Rockefeller, Nelson Rockefeller. He would talk about the fatherhood of God, brotherhood of man. And it got to the point that the press referred to it as the FOGMO. What is it? M, brother, fatherhood of God, brother. Oh, BOM, FOGBOM. Right. All these speeches are going to end with fatherhood of God, brotherhood of man. Right. By the way, that's a remarkable thing to think about. I mean, Nelson Rockefeller was not some kind of devout guy. He was not an impressively, you know, religious person. But he knew that speaking to America in the 1950s, those were the kind of things you needed to say, you know, if you were going to get a hearing, how things have changed. But in any event, stump speech, there are certain phrases which you're going to hear. Remember the importance of what the Beatitudes are. The Beatitudes, I know, in religious ed, you had the be happy attitudes. Now, if we're going to give a little more substance to that, what you're getting in the Beatitudes is they come at the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew. And what our Lord is laying out there is this is the end or the goal of the Christian life. The Christian life is a happy life. That's one of the things that secular people don't understand, where they think it's happy in the way that, like, the Flanders on The Simpsons, you know, are happy, right? This sort of cheesy happiness that, like, you know, if you're just immersed in religion somehow, it's like you like eating your broccoli, or, you know, like the Flanders kids at dinner. Liver helps us grow. You know, it's just, it's unbelievable goodness. No, the Christian life is a happy life, but it's not a happy life the way that most people understand happiness. So you think about those first two Beatitudes, right? Blessed are the poor, blessed are the meek, blessed are those who mourn. Those Beatitudes are there to help you understand that those are the things that people think you're going to be happy by power and by wealth and those things. And no, those are actually not what's going to make you happy. So if you look at the end of the Beatitudes, the pure of heart, the peacemakers, in other words, it's this connection with God, it's union with God that's truly going to make you happy. So it's important that the Beatitudes are there at the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, because they're helping the hearer understand the life I'm proposing to you is a happy life. But again, it's not happiness in the way that you understand it. When you look at the Beatitudes in Luke, he gives four Beatitudes, not, you know, depending on how you count, seven or eight in Matthew. But he gives four of them, and then they're paired with these woes. And remember, the idea of a woe, we had woes in Isaiah. I think there were seven of them or so. But the idea is, this is our Lord making a kind of a declamation or a condemnation of some group of people for their bad behavior. you are getting what's coming to you because of how you've acted. So let's look at these Beatitudes. We've got blessed are the poor, blessed are those who hunger, blessed are those who weep, blessed are those who are hated and reviled. And in Matthew, we don't have woes. We have eight or so of these Beatitudes. But here we have four of them, and then they're paired with woe to those of you who are rich, woe to those of you who are full, woe to those of you who laugh, woe to those of you who are spoken of well. Okay, so blessings and happiness for these folks, right? Unhappiness and condemnation for these folks. Please remember when we have this distinction between poor and rich. In fact, I'll, when we do this unit with the sophomores, I'll say, is the teaching here $30,000 a year of household income or lower, you are going to heaven. $30,000 to, let's say, $60,000 a year, there's some chance of heaven, but you're going to be in purgatory for a long time. $60,000 a year household income or more, we're going to send you your mail on asbestos because it's just going to be crackle, crackle, sizzle, sizzle. I mean, they pick up pretty quickly that there would be something sort of absurd about that. So, what handwriting problem?
No,
I really should be writing big. It's hard for me to make myself write big.
What's the first word on the top on lament?
Lament, prophecy, threat.
Okay.
Yeah, lament, prophecy, threat.
Thank you.
And so I always say them aloud, but you write them down before I say them. So and then you get I need to write this down. That's why generally with like the high schoolers, I write as I go along. Because otherwise, all they do is write what's down on the board and they don't listen to you. And then they take their notes home and they have no idea what they mean. That's very often when I have to start the next class and I say, okay, you wrote that down. What does that mean? And they look at me, I don't know. Gosh. Yeah, gosh. It's like Pavlov's dogs. You know, you ring the bell and they salivate, you write things on the board and they write it down. What does any of that mean? I don't know. That's in a way what you're in 8th and 9th grade, you're just trying to get them actually to write things down. But like 10th, 11th, and 12th, you're trying to get them to understand what they wrote down. Yeah, because we can't send them off to college and just, no, I write things down. It could be a command for more writing, could be a Morse code, it could be squiggles, it doesn't matter. I just put it in my notes, that's my job. So in pairing these things, poor and rich, if it's not income, if it's not $60,000 a year or more, really the issue comes down to greed. You can have people who are lower income who are greedy. You can have people who are upper income who are generous. It isn't simply a matter of what your income level is. And let's define our terms. By greed, we're talking about the excessive love of money, the excessive love of wealth. Very often, greed will simply be done interchangeably with vanity. And I know with high school kids, they don't really understand greed at all as a vice. Greed is something that you grow, generally that you grow into. What do I mean by that? Think of like Ebenezer Scrooge, the greedy old man. As you get older, you can actually just sit there and appreciate money. You can just sit there and think about rates on return and, you know, investments and profit and the bottom line. When you are 19 years old, you are not thinking about that. For you, money is just useful. What you care about is the pleasure or the things that money can buy you, or really it ends up being more a vanity. In other words, when you're young, you care more about money to show off with it. You know, here are my $120 sneakers. But when you're older, you can actually just sit there and think about, you can be like Scrooge McDuck, like swimming in the money in your vault. And that could be enjoyable to you. That's the kind of thing that when you're young, you just don't get. I would listen to my parents when I was a teenager talking about like house mortgages and interest rates and so on. And I remember thinking, my God, is this what being an adult is like? Is this what adult life is like? Yes! Yes, it is! those who hunger versus those who are full. And again, this isn't simply a matter of how much are you eating. It's a matter of how important is food to you. Especially when we talk about, there's a little unit with in the Screwtape Letters when we talk about gluttony. And the kids, of course, their default is it's amount if you're eating somehow too much. And I will point out to them, if you're a teenager, if you're like 16, 17 years old, and especially like these boys who are playing football, I don't know that there really is a too much. They burn off everything that they eat. They eat like a wolf pack, and they burn it off. Gluttony here, I said, for you, is going to be more of an issue of the kind of things you're eating. So in other words, at 16, you can be as picky and demanding as you were when you were six. At the point where it's like you just come home, and you don't ask your mom, how was your day, how are things going, what's for dinner? Yeah, like she's your chef. Like somehow mom is just sitting there waiting to serve. Well, we have a fine array of dishes available for you. What would you like to start with? Would you like to start with a soup or a salad? No. Your mom, your dad, they're not like the kitchen staff who are right waiting to serve you when you walk in the door. So that would be, I would say, more of an issue for gluttony, not just you're eating an amount. Or amounts matter. They can. But more often than not, it's what kind of food, how is it prepared, is it the way I like it, am I getting it when I want, how bent out of shape am I when it's not in the way that I want it, in the way that I like it, and so on. That is probably more likely where you actually see gluttony.
Would it also be thinking about food all the time?
Possibly, but remember, you could have somebody who is thinking about food, but they really are controlling themselves. You know, so it's not so much, in a way, you don't have a lot of control over what you're thinking. But what you do have control over is how you act. So like if you're talking about it all the time, you're trying to insinuate it into conversations, if you're sitting there just always kind of comparing restaurants and preparation and whatnot, yeah, it can that be excessive. Obviously, if you're a professional chef, it's your job. But even then, there are things that you... There's a space that you need to give yourself where you're not just like focused on food, just like for the rest of us, you can't just focus on your job. I don't want to go home and talk about teenagers. Yeah, go ahead.
Is gluttony exclusively referencing food?
Yes. So but we use gluttony, we use it with regard to other things. What are you thinking of that you would say the word gluttony about?
Somebody's addicted to something. Or you know, like exercise or any other sort of excessive use of anything.
So that would be gluttony metaphorically.
Okay.
Just like greed. You can talk about greed with regard to all sorts of other things, but if you're talking about in the strict sense of what greed is, it's about money. And you're right, you can talk about being gluttonous for electronic use in a way. You're just self. But then what you're doing is taking a word that belongs to food and now extending it to these other things. But I'm not saying that that's a bad thing. And it could be, quite frankly, with let's say our young people, they're more likely to be gluttons about, let's say, electronics than they are about food. So I would, but in this context, you know, it's more like that. Yeah, go ahead, Cesarian.
When COVID first hit, then there was like that run on toilet paper. Would that be considered gluttony then too? People running out and buying like.
No, that's more fear. I mean, I think people did that because they were worried there just wasn't going to be any.
And then it becomes self-perpetuating,
of course. But
couldn't that be considered as gluttony where you're hoarding these?
Oh, could hoarding be gluttonous? I suppose the same impulses that guide gluttony, again, could be transferred over to forms of hoarding. But hoarding sounds more to me like greed.
Yeah.
In other words, it's like you've got these supplies and you just enjoy seeing that full room of supplies. Yeah. In fact, wherever you have just the enjoyment of the having of a thing, that sounds more like greed. Right? Remember, for kids, they don't just want to have things. They want to be able to spend them, use them, show them off. When you're older, yeah, you can just look at... I mean, when you think about the cat lady, you know, or you think about the woman whose attic is just full of magazines. You know, what 15-year-old is going to have like a room full of magazines like that? They're just not going to hoard them the same way. They're not going to collect the same way. That tends to be the kind of vice that you're attracted to with age. And it's not to say there aren't younger people who say, but that's unusual. That's unusual. It happens, but it's unusual. The profile tends to be older. Does that help your question?
Yeah, I was just curious if my kids were going to come home in a few years and tell me I was wrong.
But remember, we will take these words and extend them. You know, so we talk about a lust to kill. You know, lust, strictly speaking, is sexual. But we can take the intensity of that desire and now move it over to other kinds of desires. But no, it can be helpful sometimes to move it. By the way, I think of, you know, with regard to electronics, there were a group of sophomore girls, they're all sitting around talking on the couch, but no, they're not talking. They're all on their phones. And one of the teachers comes over and says, well, who are you guys all texting? They're all texting each other. Okay, and then the teacher asks, well, why don't you just set down your phones and talk to each other? And one girl looks up, genuine puzzlement. Well, why would we do that?
Wow.
Yeah. To me, that's, that's funny, but there's something almost alarming about that. There is nothing more normal than 15-year-old girls sort of hanging out together, chattering away, talking away, and at the point where they're next to each other and they're almost silent. And the only way they feel as though they can comfortably communicate is on their phones. There's something post-human about that. You are so dependent on that device that you can no longer humanly interact anymore. It almost made me, in fact, I told this to Mr. Yeager, our principal. It just took me back to being about 11 years old, and maybe I shouldn't say this publicly, just having stacks of Mad Magazine, Cracked Magazine, and sitting around and reading these things together and reading them out to each other and making up and drawing our own sort of poor cartoon versions of Spy versus Spy or these comics that were in Mad Magazine. I would never suspect, you know, offer this as here we are on this intellectual level. No, but there was this personal engagement and personal interaction between these sixth grade boys in the garage in the summer, and it involved reading and talking and creative. And there was no technology that was a part of that. And I just feel as though there was something more human going on there than just people on machines talking to each other, restricted by the machine. You know, imagine, here I am, nostalgic for the days of Mad Magazine as a sixth grader. You know, that shows you we're not talking about little high culture here.
Finally, is that maybe social media that they're on,
oh, yeah,
rather than talking to each other?
Yeah. Well, because they're communicating through things like Snapchat and Instagram.
Yeah, but yeah.
Yeah.
That stuff's bad.
Yep. Like, yep.
Can kids use their phones here now,
yeah,
during the day?
No. Until 8:30. Remember, once the school day begins, then it has to be in their lockers.
Oh.
But that's the thing. Right before school and after school, you couldn't pry it from their cold, dead fingers.
Yeah.
Remember, we used to say that about guns.
Yeah.
You'll take my gun from me when you pry from my cold, dead. That's the way they are about their phones. I mean, they would die, and their phone would be in this like rough in their hands, and you wouldn't be able to get it out. Yeah, yeah. Sometimes I've heard that, you know, for very disciplined, you got to take a phone from a kid. Sometimes they'll start trembling. Yeah. What do you expect? They have it on them all day long. Why wouldn't they?
Yeah.
And especially if you've had a phone since you were like 10, 11, 12 years old, this is like, it's like your blankie, it's like your stuffed animal, it's like that never goes away. You know, it's like the blankie you get to keep into adulthood. remember that when you're talking about Provident students from 15 years ago, you're talking about kids who were like getting phones as they were becoming teenagers, right? Because they weren't as available, weren't as accessible, right? But now you're talking about kids who've maybe have had them since grade school. So they're almost their whole conscious life has involved those things, right? So you're just talking about very, very, very different mindset, habits of mind. I have those who weep and those who laugh. I didn't have a quite a capital sin to put with that. So I put sloth as a question mark. Remember, sloth is not just laziness. Sloth is spiritual laziness. So that you can't get out of bed to go to work. You don't sweep the leaves that are piling up in the backyard. You know what I mean? That could be just laziness. But that you just can't get out of bed to go to church, that you can't ever make yourself pray. That's what sloth is. Sloth is sorrow at the effort that's involved in a spiritual life. You know, as a capital sin. So when I saw those, blessed are those who weep, those who laugh. This is somebody who's able to live a penitential life. Whereas those who laugh, this is somebody who's just not able to take that kind of effort, undergo that kind of pain. They just sort of want it to be pleasant. And so they forego the rigors of a Christian life because it's just, from their point of view, it's just too much work. So, but I'm not, that's why I put a question mark. This one's easier. Blessed are those who are hatred and reviled. Woe to those where they speak well of you. And maybe in a Christian society that people speak well of you, well, aren't you behaving well that they would be speaking well of you? But remember, when this is formulated, there's the understanding that in embracing the Christian life, you know, for the foreseeable future, this is going to make you hated. This is going to be something where your life is going to be harder. By becoming a disciple, by following Jesus, your life is going to be harder. So, you know, you can be hated and reviled for all sorts of the right reasons. I mean, it could be you're just a jerk, you know, and so people hate you for that. But no, the understanding here is that you are hated and reviled for my sake, that you have embraced this way of life, and that's why it is you're hated and reviled. And conversely, that people speak well of you because you don't really embrace this. You fit in with the world. You fit with the world. The world, as our Lord puts it, loves its own. You know, the world loves you because it recognizes its own. And there, that's where I put vanity there, because vanity is not just you look in the mirror and you know, Lord, it's so hard to be humble when you're perfect in every way. Can't wait to look in the mirror because I get better looking each day. So we're not talking about that kind of vanity, but the vanity where you have an excessive regard for people's good opinion. You want to be loved. You want to be respected. You want to fit in. If I were to choose a kind of a... When people ask... Catholic life in the United States, if you look in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, it had its problems. But, Catholics were following what they understood to be church teaching. And then in the 60s and 70s, it's like, you know, the train goes off the tracks. You know, what happened? And it's a kind of a sociological explanation, but the shortest explanation is Catholics wanted to be accepted. They didn't want to be the odd ones out. They didn't want to just be this immigrant church, this kind of lower income, lower education. And that Kennedy got elected as president, that a Roman Catholic got elected as president. There were a lot of Catholics that felt, finally, we're accepted. Like Sally Field at the Grammys, or at the Academy Awards. They like me. You really like me. It was almost that. And that's especially when you're a minority population in a majority population. You always want to be able to fit in. You always want to be able to be loved and respected. And generally, that's been the pattern with a lot of Catholic institutions. They are what they are because they wanted to be loved, respected. They wanted to fit in. Yeah. So, woe to you when they speak well of you. Because it means you are not following the path that I've laid for you. Finally, let's look at there's this long section, 27 to 36, about love of enemies. And usually this is the thing that I will focus on, especially with sophomores and juniors, about kind of the distinctive, what I will call them, distinctive works of grace. especially when you have sacraments and you're going through sacraments with them. Okay, you're baptized, you're confirmed, you've received the Eucharist. What is it that allows you to do? And, you know, you get back things like, be a good person. Okay, well, aren't there atheists out there and agnostics out there who are decent people, good people? Yeah. Okay, then what's the distinctive work of grace? Silence. They don't readily have something. And so I have to point out, well, if you look at if you look at characterizations of Christianity, you know, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Golden rule. You know, maybe you'll have a student who will say that. But then you point out that, well, Buddha says that, you know, and Confucius says that. That's like the first and basic precept of general beneficence. You know, do good to all men. All men are your brothers. That's everywhere. That isn't something that's uniquely Christian. You know, that's something, in a way, that's part of the natural law. That's part of the law that's written on the human heart. And they don't readily have a picture of what these actions are that are above just being a you know, kind of good to all people or doing unto others as you would have them do unto you. So that's why I'll talk about things like, for example, forgiveness, right? I'll talk about Immaculée Ilagabiza. This is the Rwandan woman who is with seven other women stuck in a bathroom while the genocide was going on against her people, and comes out at the end of that. Her family has been all hacked up by neighbors, Hutu neighbors that were two blocks above the up the street, and they come to her and they admit, "We hacked up your family," and they seek forgiveness, and she forgives them. Okay. Now, that is not something that you are doing by your own natural steam. You are not doing that by your natural ability. And I will tell students, if you hear that story and inside you're just thinking, no way, no way, I would never forgive them. That is an entirely human and understandable reaction. Now you are in a position to understand what a distinctive work of grace is. A distinctive work of grace is going to allow you to do those things that you just think in the inside, no way, there is no way I would ever forgive someone who did that to my family. Because these distinctive works of grace are supposed to allow you to do things that are supernatural, that they are not possible naturally. They're not possible naturally. Okay? So martyrdom is an easy one, but martyrdom is not as easy anymore because post 9/11, you will have kids who say, well, but don't people fly planes into buildings and martyr themselves? I mean, does that mean they have sanctifying grace? And of course, you have to point out to them the difference. Christian martyrs would die, and their idea wasn't that they were taking out a bunch of people with them. You know, so let's be clear about martyrdom. But forgiveness and love of enemies, this really is something that is distinctively Christian. It's something that our Lord clearly spent several verses on in Luke. So it is a good example to use. I wrote here, you know, effect of enlightenment materialism. I think part of the reason why we have this do unto others as you would have them do unto you, the golden rule, that somehow that's what morality is and there's nothing higher than that. Part of that flows from the impact of science on our understanding of human nature. And that is, we think of human beings totally in materialistic and selfish terms. So in other words, that human beings are caring for each other and doing things for each other, that to them just seems religious. That to them just seems like there has to be something higher at work. And you have to point out, no, that people care about each other, support each other, they're brave for each other. You can look at cultures all over the world and they've got that. It only seems amazing to you because you are growing up in a country that is self-indulgent and self-centered. That's why it seems so amazing to you. But that, you know, that to act selfishly is not natural. Remember, the animals, whatever you want to say about animals, their instincts do not allow them to act selfishly. Animals are not selfish. When you are looking at salmon swimming up a river in Alaska to spawn up in the mountain somewhere, Whatever you want to say about that, that's not selfish. If they were selfish, they would just stay in the Atlantic, you know, getting a regular diet, as opposed to going up white water past grizzly bears who are slapping them out of the water and eating them. Almost all sorts of reproductive strategies, especially, for example, among insects, they're all self-destructive. I don't have to talk to you about spiders, do I? Right? A lot of spiders, you know, having spiderlings isn't necessarily great for mama. So whatever you want to say about nature, nature is not selfish. But what we're called to is not just don't be selfish. That's everywhere. All societies are going to teach people not to be selfish. We are called to a kind of a self-sacrifice, and more importantly, a love of others that's only possible by God infusing his grace in our hearts. There's no way you're going to love your enemies in the way that you're called to do so as a Christian unless God is moving your heart in that way, elevating your human potential, elevating your human powers. There's no way that's going to happen unless. I wanted to talk about judging a tree by its fruit, but maybe next time. So hopefully you're able to do restful things over MEA. Hopefully this isn't for teachers and students. Oh, I'm seeing head shaking. Oh, I'm sorry. But remember, we have MEA because teachers really do lead a very, very hard life. It's a very, very hard life. And so thank you. And I'm sorry that you don't have the vacation. Yes, exactly. Very good. Next week, Luke 7.
We're blessed to have you, Dr.
Thank you.